Well, here we are on a Thursday morning, live in probably one of the most interesting, exciting, and tumultuous election seasons in history. And no, I'm not talking about our elections, which are now only a couple of weeks behind us, with a government of national unity and all kinds of shenanigans happening there. I'm talking about the US elections. And of course, there is a smorgasbord of stuff to discuss there. Just over the weekend, couple of hours ago, really, Donald Trump narrowly surviving an assassination attempt. The Secret Service coming under huge fire since then for whether or not they did the best job possible. We're looking at what's going on at the Republican National Convention. For anyone who's into U.S. politics, you're in for a treat today because Pumi and I are going to be talking to David Smith in Washington. Morning, Pums. How are you?
Hello, baby. It's been a very long year, but this week has been particularly long. I couldn't believe it when I woke up on Sunday morning. Jesus. And so I'm extremely excited because everything that's happening, I told you guys, every day, unprecedented historical events every single day. Well,
we were very nearly unprecedented on Saturday evening in America, Sunday morning in South Africa. It's just the mind boggles at what the world would sound and look like had that assassin succeeded in his goal.
And I actually can't believe that I haven't seen a statement from the AU calling for calm. But I do want to say when David comes on that we can lend them officials from the IEC for their upcoming election.
Well, I'll tell you what is interesting. I mean, like, I do find that funny because, you know, we've also given the US, I think, duly a lot of noise and shit about the fact that our elections were free and fair and they were uncontested and we didn't have our major political candidates standing around declaring the election invalid. We did have that with MK, of course, but then MK are like the lunatic fringe in South Africa. But by and large, you know, we like to give the Americans as good as we get. Of course, the interesting thing, the observation which everyone is making already, is that if you try to kill the leading political candidate on the right, people don't go to the streets and riot and burn shit and steal from stores and set the country on fire. But if that had happened on the left, I wonder if we could say the same, because when it happened with George Floyd, we certainly couldn't. And that's largely something that was supported by the left. I mean, we had the Democrats bending over backwards and people in the media saying, oh, it was mostly peaceful protests, you know, courthouses and police stations set on fire. None of that happened in the wake of this assassination attempt. So I think there is a profound difference. These are not the same things.
Well, look, I mean, I don't know if it would have been only people on the left if it had happened anywhere else in the world. And I do think that what we also, there's a lot of things that we can take away from the past couple of days coming out of America. And it's the thing about America is this is not the first time, right? American presidents do get assassinated. Americans in 1981, Ronald Reagan was shot. I mean, this is in America. America has a gun culture that is crazy. And this is guns in America.
I'm sorry, to link this to gun crime in America is ludicrous. A political assassination of an entire
country. I didn't say gun crime. I said America's relationship with guns.
For me, let's start this
in America.
Okay. All right. Well, let's bring David in.
Yes. We've
got so much to get into. Yeah. Where do we go from here after a couple of really tumultuous days on the political scene? Well, joining us this morning to try and make sense of this is someone who's been on the ground in so many of these recent U.S. happenings, The Guardian's Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief David Smith. He is live from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where the Republicans are having their Republican National Convention. And, of course, you might recognize him from his time here in South Africa as the Africa correspondent for The Guardian. David, it's really good to see you again. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks very much. And yeah, just what you were touching on. Yeah, I remember the old jokes about, you know, Zimbabwe sending election monitors to America, which the way things are going, might be a good idea.
Well,
And very much awake. We're excited to have you with us this morning.
it's great to be here. Yeah, and I was following the South African elections with great interest, having lived there for 6 years, of course. And as we know, this is a banner year for democracy because the country where I was born, Britain, also had an election a few weeks ago, the big victory for the Labour Party. And again, the losing Prime Minister there, Rishi Sunak, actually made some comments about there will be a peaceful transfer of power, goodwill on all sides. That was a notable comment about the nature of democracy because, again, here in America, there are fears over what will happen in November if it's a disputed result. And, mindful of January the 6th, 2021, could there be some kind of repeat? As you also say, and I'm still trying to get my head around this fact that we were this close, like an inch or less from the assassination of Donald Trump, which, for journalists would possibly be something on a scale a bit like John F. Kennedy or 9/11, and where would the country be now? Some people have said America could have plunged into some kind of civil war. That's extreme, but maybe a certainly sort of low level violence. And yeah, that's a an alternative future that the world avoided by like a fraction of an inch.
Well, David, you're at the RNC, and it's not like the comments haven't come out from some really big hitters in the Republican Party that if Donald Trump does not get elected, there will be mayhem. The country will be plunged into mayhem.
Yeah, I think both sides in this election are pitching it as the most important of our lifetimes, and they admit, well, we say that every 4 years, but this time it's real. Sadly, and the assassination attempt was possibly part of this. Politics has become very polarized, and every election is like an Armageddon election where it's no longer just kind of, okay, they've got one set of policies and we have another. It's a battle for the soul of the country. It's a competition between one way of life and another, one understanding of America and another. It always feels existential that, if our side wins, then that's total victory. And if the other side wins, it's the apocalypse. It's utterly devastating. It's the end of the world. And it's a shame when it's seen in those terms because that leads to tribalism, political violence,
And
viewing your
sometimes assassinations.
indeed, yeah, viewing your opponent as your enemy, so on and so on. And we shall see if the assassination attempt pulls America back from the brink. Could that be some moment of catharsis? I mean, some of the talk here in Milwaukee is that perhaps some kind of shift in tone. It was notable when the shooting happened, Donald Trump's own first response was to tell his supporters, fight, fight, fight. And by the way, whatever you think of Trump, you have to acknowledge he's a brilliant master of spectacle. He had the presence of mind to stand up and raise his fist and be photographed. In the immediate hours afterwards, his Republican allies were blaming Democrats and Joe Biden
Yes.
for accusing Trump of being a fascist and that leading to the shooting. But notably, Trump struck a different tone, and now those Republicans have pulled back, and we've not heard so much of that during this convention. Of course, they're bashing Biden and the Democrats, but they're not quite blaming him for the assassination. And the prediction tomorrow night for Trump's address is that he will try to be more of a unifier, try to lower the political temperature. There's some hope maybe that America could pull back. On the other hand, Trump being Trump, I'm sure a week from now he'll be back to his old dark and divisive rhetoric.
Yes, David, you say that about taking the moment. I mean, what it was so, for me, a media person, magnificent to watch that Donald Trump has such a presence of mind and such a deep and intuitive understanding of media and what media can do, that in that moment, I mean, those pictures coming out with him and his fist up, the American flag behind him, the fact that he can hear in some of the microphones, actually some of that like chaos aftermath, he's asking about his shoe. He's in that moment, yeah. The man is thinking, I'm not walking out here in a sock with like disheveled and all sorts of things. But I think it also raises something quite fascinating, because some of the images that I've seen coming out over the past couple of days is again contrasting the vibrancy of Donald Trump, the youthfulness of Donald Trump in contrast with Joe Biden. I mean, the man survived an assassination attempt and Joe Biden can hardly string a sentence together. What do you think these kind of moments of in the media and what people are seeing, what kind of effect will that have on the voter going forward? Or is it just too far in advance?
No, I think it's important. I think when we look back on this election year, it may well be that the two pivotal events were the first presidential debate, which I was at in Atlanta, where, as you say, Biden was projecting that weakness and he was bumbling and mumbling and rambling and struggling to finish sentences. And even on that occasion, you could see Trump's understanding of television as a medium, not only when he spoke, but in the split screen when he was responding to Biden, you know, the facial expressions, whereas Biden was just kind of staying off to the middle distance with his mouth slightly agape. And then, of course, as you say, this assassination attempt on Saturday, Trump's response was stunning. I mean, I think in that moment, he did become one of the all-time great showmen. Just that understanding of spectacle, even having just survived by inches to, as you say, have the presence of mind, just the instinct to stand up with the fist, the blood on the face, the flag behind him, producing iconic photographs that I have seen here in Milwaukee are already now festooned all over T-shirts. Mm-hmm. He is a media master. And the bottom line of all of this is indeed Trump projecting strength and Biden projecting weakness. And then in addition to that, here at this Republican National Convention, there's tremendous party unity rallying around Trump after what happened on Saturday, treating him almost like a saint, like a martyr, huge support for him. And then again, a very striking contrast with the Democrats, where Biden's age has led to division and internal conflict and a huge debate over whether to try and oust him as the party nominee and choose someone else. And so we'll see how that convention goes in Chicago next month. A whole series of events have given Trump political momentum right now.
David, I want to talk a little bit about Biden in a moment, because you've spent a bit of time around him. I believe you were at a couple of the events that they've had at the White House recently. You've seen him at the NATO summit, and we've seen him too on our screens across the world. And there's obviously a lot of cause for concern there. But just to finish up with Trump, because I don't want to move swiftly on from this. I do think it's a historic event. I think you and Pumi have very, very executed rather and explained the situation around why this is such an iconic thing. And America in particular, Pumi said at the beginning of the show, and she's not wrong, political assassinations are nothing new in America. And we, you know, all the way back to Lincoln, Jackson, Roosevelt, Teddy, and FDR at some point, survived assassination attempts. Teddy Roosevelt's much more celebrated. John F. Kennedy, obviously, in the 60s, Ronald Reagan in the 80s. And this is part of kind of the high stakes game that American politics really does get reduced to these situations. I think probably it's interesting to see how, you know, either candidate has reacted. Biden's options were very limited in terms of how he could react. And I think he probably did the best he could, considering all the things that are arrayed against him at the moment. But Donald Trump seems to be striking a much more moderate tone. You mentioned earlier how you think he's going to go for unity here. Of course, he has the ability to maneuver that way now, because people watched him narrowly survive death, which in any hero story is a big part of kind of what people love. A story in the first place is what people go for. Do you think that his choice of J.D. Vance is also a precipitated result of what's happened in the last couple of days? Is he a kind of assassination insurance in a way, because he's perhaps a bigger fear of the Democrats than Trump himself might be? He's 39 years old, extremely smart, comes from a blue-collar background in the Appalachians, wrote Hillbilly Elegy, has been a senator for all of 5 minutes. You know, these are all things to consider. And I think Trump nominating him as the VP and, you know, some of the other people who've spoken at the Republican National Convention, fiery as some of those might have been, I think they've all been tamped down a little bit. Trump has options. And this was not the case just a couple of days ago. He may have chosen someone who was more politically useful to him 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, just very quickly on a couple of those early points. Yeah, 4 U.S. presidents have been assassinated. I'm afraid violence has always been a part of American society from, you know, settling in the West, genocide of Native Americans, slavery, and so on.
Hang on, before we go down that road, you Brits, and I'm not going to say you because you're a citizen of the world now. But the Brits have had their fair share of this. And here in South Africa, we've had our fair share of it, too. I mean, Jacob Zuma claimed to have had an assassination attempt on him just a couple of weeks ago.
Listen, he sent out a letter yesterday, the Jacob Zuma Foundation, referencing the assassination attempt on Trump, asking for increased security from the presidency. They're just like,
and famously,
shot.
We had a sitting president killed in the 60s in Hendrik Verwoerd with Dimitri Tsifendis. So I don't know that this is uniquely American, but it certainly is a part of the picture, right?
That's right. And tonight at the convention, Donald Trump Jr. retold the story of the Teddy Roosevelt assassination attempt that you cited, because it was just a few miles from here in Milwaukee. And they're enjoying drawing a comparison with Trump as the man in the arena, because Teddy Roosevelt, you know, finished his speech, even though blood was seeping through his shirt. And it's been striking at the convention.
He famously said, "It'll take more to kill the bull moose than that."
Indeed. It's been striking during the convention how, yes, this has elevated Trump, if that's possible, to something near sainthood in the eyes of in what was already a cult of personality here. You know, he's bigger than the Republican Party now. And many of the convention speakers have talked of this in terms of divine providence, how, you know, the hand of God was on his shoulder, or God made him tilt his head at that point. They're really casting it in these divine Christian terms. But to answer your main question, no, I don't think J.D. Vance was selected as a consequence of that, partly because there was widespread reporting, including things I'd heard, that Vance had already been selected ahead of the assassination attempt on Saturday. I think it has more to do partly with him coming from the Rust Belt in America, those states in the Midwest that were deindustrialized and felt left behind. The 2024 election is probably going to be decided in those states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and Vance is seen as a very useful asset. He's going to spend a lot of time in Pennsylvania in particular. But also, of all the potential VP picks, Vance is really part of the Make America Great Again movement. He became Trump's biggest ally in the Senate, where you still have some of the more traditional, old school Republicans. He's a, you know, having been a sharp critic of Trump in 2016 and even referred to him as America's Hitler, Vance now has the zeal of the convert. You know, he's all in with Trumpism and MAGA, as it's known. And in his speech tonight, he talked about trying to connect with those working class voters who were hard done by in, you know, trade deals and shipping jobs to China and so on. He's had some very extreme views on abortion in the past. Notably, internationally, he seems to be a real America First isolationist who has said he doesn't care what happens to Ukraine So I think this selection by Trump is a real vote of self-confidence that he really thinks he's going to win this election. He can have someone who's a political ally. He doesn't need someone to broaden his appeal or be complimentary. And what you may also see is that, you know, if Trump moderates a bit in the light of this shooting, and if he's adopts a softer tone, then perhaps Vance will be his foil and will be his attack dog.
Mm.
So
sorry, Pumps, go ahead.
You know, because you're at the RNC and you have a front row seat to all of this kind of, and we have seen over the past couple of years how much bigger than the party Trump has become. I'm also interested to know, which we don't get because of the filter of the sea over here, we don't get as much, is on the ground with people outside the party, with the voting public, how have they responded to all the events of the past couple of days? And some of the polls that I saw, even after the disastrous debate, the difference in the polling between Trump and Biden wasn't so big. So how has the past couple of days impacted on that?
Yeah, I was just in an event today where a Republican pollster was reminding us all of that point, that the vast majority of Americans have already made up their minds. They're on one side or the other. Not least, of course, because both these candidates are so well known. In a normal presidential election, you've got two new candidates you're learning about, or at least an incumbent president versus a new challenger, and there's all sorts of revelations about who they are and their background. This time, for the first time in ages, you have two candidates who've already served one term each. There's not many secrets about them, and most of it is baked in, and really, there's a very narrow band of voters left who are still undecided or might switch from one to the other. So even seismic events like Biden's terrible debate performance or the attempted assassination or other things are only likely to shift the needle a few points one direction or the other. And then, of course, within that, the actual election itself and the Electoral College will be decided in a handful of states. We're talking about very tight margins here where every variable can make a difference.
So on that
somebody
note,
in the comments.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Gareth. Somebody in the comments is asking about RFK, and I also wanted to ask about the leaked telephone call. That was weird.
It was. That appears to have been Robert Kennedy Jr.'s son recording that and posted on social media, and Robert Kennedy Jr. then apologized for it. I mean, the contents of that call suggest Trump shares quite a lot of Kennedy's vaccine skepticism. And at an event yesterday, Trump's son, Donald Jr., said he was open to the idea of Robert Kennedy serving in a Trump administration, and one could guess that might be as health secretary. So we shall have to see. But Kennedy remains an unknown in this election. Some people think he will hurt Biden more. Some people think he'll hurt Trump more as a third party candidate. I think the latest polling suggests maybe slightly Biden more. And again, for the reason I was just saying about how close it is and how many people have made up their minds, Kennedy could take a few thousand votes from one candidate or the other. That could make all the difference in the battleground states that decide everything.
So on that note, I think, the Democrats really could not have had a worse run of luck or have fucked this up worse themselves, because it kind of started to go downhill when everybody was forced to admit what the media has been lying to us about for ages, that Biden is in severe cognitive decline, that this man can't string a sentence together, that he walks like Mr. Burns from The Simpsons, that he mostly has a vacant expression on his face, and unless Jill is guiding him around, he's in no way capable of having complex conversations. Lester Holt this week interviewed him and came out quite strong. I noticed that even, some of the big Biden allies in the media who have always given him a soft touch have been, George Stephanopoulos, for example, have been quite hard with him because they're all trying desperately to recover some credibility after telling the American public there's nothing wrong with him. He's fine for the longest time. This morning, Joy Reid, apparently, on MSNBC, along with Jen Psaki, the former White House press secretary, were both saying, well, you know, if Joe Biden survives his latest bout of COVID, he must be regarded the same way as Trump surviving the assassin's bullet. And this kind of thing has just got, I mean, it's got most of us in hysterics because I have started to doubt many of the mainstream media sources or had many, many years ago. But Joe Biden now is an unmitigated disaster, and yet they have to stick with him. You've actually spent time with him, though, and I value your opinion. I'd like to know what you think of him, whether you've had conversations, whether you've monitored him up close. You were at the NATO summit. You were at the White House not so long ago. You get to see him. What's he like in your estimation? And if he's not good, who's actually the unelected person running the government at the moment?
Well, one thing dynamic that's interesting about this is I think the further you are away from Biden, the worse he looks. For a couple of years, I've had, for example, colleagues in the UK saying this is madness. He's so old, he's feeble, he can't do the job. To which I replied, well, you know, I see him up close to the White House. You know, generally he's fine. He has good days and bad days. More often they're good days. I mean, he gives speech fine. And actually, even with Trump, something similar would kind of happen in that nationally and especially internationally, you'd get those clips on the news of Trump saying something bonkers and think, you know, this is a raving lunatic. And I would go to White House events and see him do these kind of ceremonial things and give speeches and actually sort of see that sometimes normal things were happening. with Biden, I think
faint praise. Sometimes normal things were happening.
Which with Trump is a surprise. Now with Biden, yeah, I think the bad days are becoming more frequent. There have been times I've been on the White House South Lawn and seen him walking from the Marine One helicopter, and you're kind of slightly on tenterhooks, thinking, you know, can he make it? He looks so stiff and fragile as he walks there. Other times he gives speeches, he's absolutely fine. I mean, it's earlier this year that he had the benefit of low expectations. He delivered the State of the Union address, 9 p.m. on Capitol Hill, spoke for an hour or more. He was terrific. He was very energetic. People were surprised by it. He sparred with Republicans, got the better of them. And he had enough moments like that to silence the critics. You know, just when people were ready to turn on him, he would do something that quelled that rebellion. But then, of course, came the debate, and that was one of the worst nights of all. But just to go back before then, what I would also say is I had a weekend following Joe Biden around. It was my first time flying on Air Force One. We went to a couple of battleground states. I saw Biden up close doing five engagements, you know, talking to people at a restaurant, giving a speech at an NAACP dinner, speaking at a fundraiser. And my verdict there was, well, you know, actually this was a pretty hectic weekend. And for an 81-year-old, he did pretty well. On the other hand, you know, of course he was not Barack Obama. Of course he was not sparkling with charisma. There were some verbal gaffes. Some of it was a bit, you know, uninspiring. I mean, it was kind of, he's okay, he's fine, but it's not a crisis, seemed to be the feeling. But yes, obviously the debate was terrible. And just to, you know, one of the points you're raising, certainly there is now some soul searching among the Washington media. Part of it, I think, people held back because they didn't want to be accused of ageism. Part of it was the White House lacking the transparency that it claimed to have. Reporters who questioned Biden's age or dug into this were targeted with some hostility, and that the White House was very sensitive and pushed back hard on it. So that certainly didn't help. And the ultimate accusation, of course, was if you obsess with Biden's age, you run the risk of re-electing Donald Trump. Probably not a sensible approach, but I think that fear crept into people, you know, and the accusation was, how dare you draw a false equivalence between Biden's age versus Trump's corruption? I mean, you know, the man is on trial in New York. He's been twice impeached. He's an insurrectionist. And yet you're talking about Joe Biden's age. How dare you? And so all that played into it. But
isn't that just a terrible indictment all on its own? The fact that, you know, that the people in the media are themselves so partisan that the greatest insult to them would be, oh my God, if you keep reporting on this line, you're going to get Trump elected. I mean, if that isn't proof positive that so many journalists in Washington are there for political activist reasons rather than to report the news, then I don't know what is.
Yeah, I take that point, although I also understand the instinct to say, why obsess over the age issue when the other guy is an authoritarian preparing to tear down democracy? Well,
because the one has currently got the nuclear codes and doesn't know whether he's a teapot or a hockey stick, and the other one is out there campaigning and surviving bullets whizzing past his head and playing golf the next day. The one needs 7 days to prepare for a debate, and then when he pitches up on stage, it's clear to everyone that he's not entirely sure what's going on around him. And who do you think is actually running the show? Because Biden is asleep at like 4 PM or whatever it is and wakes up at like 9. So he's only presidenting for about a quarter of the day. Who else is in the shadows running things? And are these people in any way qualified to be making decisions about foreign policy? I mean, when you're electing a president, the American people trust you to be the head of the executive, to run the bureaucracy, to run the departments. It's evident that Biden hasn't, and Trump brought this up in the debate. He said, you've never fired anyone, which is true. I mean, Joe Biden has not fired anyone during his tenure of prominence because he's not in charge. He can't actually make any decisions. Who is?
First, I'll say I agree the fact that Biden is the incumbent means that he is worthy of at least as much scrutiny. And the White House's lack of transparency on this, of course, now has backfired, as it always does in these cases, because journalists feel they have to make up the lost ground. And now, of course, it's all hands on deck. And everything Biden says and does is scrutinized through this lens. Every gaffe, every half gaffe that in the past maybe would be ignored is now feeding the narrative that he's lost control and he's out of it and incapable of doing this job. So it was bad strategy on their part to try and play this down. You know, there's been some reporting, oh, he only works from, you know, 10 till 4 or something, and that's become Republican narrative. I mean, I don't know if that's true.
It's not true that he's not available at any time but during those hours?
You know, that's been reported. I your guess is as good as mine what's actually going on. I mean, I suspect
Can I ask this? I mean, I think there are a couple of things that are being raised by Gareth, and you've also alluded to the reporting coming out of Washington. Mainstream media and how stuff is reported, whether it's on Truth or whether it's on X or any of these other platforms, how big is the mainstream media's voice and influence over the electorate right now? And how much more of a sway is coming out of all sorts of other different places, you know, Breitbart, all of the online publications, all of those things? Who's got the bigger voice and who is being listened to? Has the ear of Americans?
Yeah, it's much more fragmented and diverse than it used to be. Of course, you know, a generation or two ago, it was 3 big TV networks and the New York Times, mm-hmm. and the Washington Post. And there was, I suppose, shared set of facts. Now, very fragmented, big networks, cable news. You know, I think they still have some sway, but it's probably fading. You know, the New York Times, Washington Post wrote editorials calling for Biden to exit this race and step aside, and it was widely noted. You know, those have less impact than they would have done 30, 50 years ago. They're now just one voice among many. And certainly, online, there are many outlets, podcasts, echo chambers, what people are saying on X. And just to take one example, before he went to prison, I interviewed Steve Bannon, former White House chief strategist. He now runs the War Room podcast. That seems to be very influential on the right. You know, Republican members of Congress go on there. You know, clips circulate on social media. You can see the ideas that get talked about on there, whether it's cutting funding from Ukraine, other concepts. You know, they work their way into mainstream Republican policy. So it's very hard to quantify now, but it's certainly fragmented, and the mainstream media has lost some of its clout. But let's not forget, of course, in that mix as well, Rupert Murdoch's Fox News, which again is still has some weight on the right, but again, you know, not calling all the shots.
Well, you know, and when the first images came out post the assassination attempt on Sunday morning, and then obviously what we watched all the way over here, at least for me, between the memes was also conspiracy theories, was also coming out of some prominent Republicans as well. You know, Joe Biden is responsible for this. It is the deep state trying to get rid of Trump. How much of a loud voice are some of those different? And we haven't heard anything concrete, I think, from the Secret Service as to the failing of what happened there. And I know in the next couple of weeks, we're going to see, you know, congressional hearings. We're definitely going to see congressional hearings and hear something about what happened there. But there are a lot of theories out there, and it reminds me of Lee Harvey Oswald with a megaphone.
Yeah, I was in Dallas last year, writing about the, you know, the 60th anniversary of the JFK assassination, and it occurred to me, by the way, if Donald Trump had died in this assassination attempt, then we would probably have had 100 years of conspiracy theories about, you know, no, he didn't die really. It was just a body double, and, you know, the real Trump is alive and he's going to come back and all that sort of thing. But in this instance, we actually had the head of the Secret Service at the Republican convention today being challenged by some Republican senators, and she just kept on walking. It was a bit of an extraordinary.
Yeah, what was she doing there?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And certainly, yeah, many conspiracy theories, of course.
You may well even ask what she was doing in the job in the first place.
Indeed.
Didn't she came from like a retail background. She was at Pepsi or something before this, right?
So perfect qualification, yeah. Certainly huge questions over how this man was allowed to get so close to this campaign rally. And as you say, there'll be investigations. And certainly the Trump family obviously feel it was a tremendous blunder, you know, worthy of investigation. It's interesting when you look at January the 6th and other instances, the conspiracy theories often thrive and almost take over the party and, you know, become an obsession. In this instance, the fact that Donald Trump himself has tried to shut all that down and not delved into it particularly, and even not gone after Democrats and said it was their rhetoric that led to this, that does seem to have had some kind of calming effect. It seems, at least for now, that was some kind of red line even he didn't want to cross, and it's very visible the party takes its lead from him. As I mentioned before, you know, on Saturday, Trump's allies were diving into X and social media, sort of posting Democratic rhetoric caused this, and it's all their fault. And then when Trump himself didn't say that, they all pulled back. And now we know a bit more about who this gunman was, and it does not appear to have had a particular ideological reason. But I think, you know, whichever way Trump goes is how a lot of the party and indeed the conspiracy theorists will follow.
So this conversation has been a lot like your election, right? We've spoken a lot about the personalities, we've spoken a lot about the media, and we've spoken very little about policy. And I'm very interested to know, being South African and with all of the stuff happening over here, and like a two-year-old, what the American government is currently looking at us and thinking, responding, reacting. We had a lot of excitement with the ambassador here talking about our relationship with Russia and the Lady R. We had a lot of excitement talking about when there was a bill put in front of some senators about re-looking the relationship between South Africa and America. There was a lot of talk here about some of our trade agreements with America and where we stand with regard to Russia, China, and Iraq, Iran. And so I'm very interested to know if any of this matters to the policy talk that the candidates have, and if anyone is even caring about us as much as we think you are.
Sadly, not much at the Republican National Convention. They did release a policy platform last week, heavily influenced by Trump and Trumpism. And you know that because it was written in block capital letters. It was pretty short and superficial. They feel probably the less they say, the better, and especially on issues such as abortion rights, which have noticeably been barely mentioned, if at all, at the convention. And sadly, as someone who used to report on Africa and used to live in Africa, I mean, I often note how little attention it gets in these forums and how little it's likely to be mentioned. But look, I think J.D. Vance's running mate is an indication of a full embrace of America first and turning away from partnerships and alliances around the world, which Joe Biden would argue he's done a lot to rebuild over the last 4 years. You hear international diplomats saying they're Trump-proofing, ready for his return to the White House. This is a guy who reportedly referred to African countries as shithole countries, of course. I certainly don't think Africa will be a priority for him. With both Democrats and Republicans, certainly there's a great deal of attention on China and concern over perhaps China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea combining as an alliance. So in as much as South African policy intersects there, that could be, you know, something to watch.
I feel like it's justifiable for us to first kind of ask about the two wars in which America is deeply involved at the moment, because I think Africa really is an afterthought compared to those. We see an enormous amount. You were at the NATO summit and you saw another tranche of money handed over to President Putin. I mean, I'm sorry, President Zelensky, by doddering old Biden. He's handing out money left, right, and center. The American economy is not exactly stellar at the moment. And we know that inflation is a real thing. And for ordinary people, regardless of what Karine Jean-Pierre says from the White House, ordinary people are feeling that things are costing more than they did 4 years ago. And that's indisputable. But I think Americans largely are concerned about these two wars, even though they haven't committed troops to either of them. They are very much tooth and nail involved, right?
Yeah, very much. Just to slightly challenge one of your points, there are many who would argue the American economy is stellar or not far off it. The best recovery from the pandemic of any major industrial nation. You know, unemployment is at a 50-year low. GDP is doing well. Even inflation is coming down.
Who would argue that the equally old Janet Yellen?
Indeed, she would certainly argue that. And certainly, I talk to people from Britain and other countries who come to America and say, "What on earth are you guys complaining about? You know, things are booming here." However, you know, I take your point, and it's been a great matter of debate here as to why the American people are not feeling that. They say the vibes are off, and yes, inflation is a factor. There's that sense of, you know, you're telling us the economic numbers are strong, but the cost of my bread, my groceries, my petrol is hurting. It's worse than four years ago. And you know, you see the slogan at Trump rallies, you know, better off under Trump. You know, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And you know, Biden has really been struggling to persuade everybody the economy is as strong as our numbers say it is. And sorry, remind me, what was your question after that?
About the wars.
The wars.
How much have they featured in both the Republican National Convention and in political discourse generally, not just around the election, but because you're the Washington guy, I mean, you'll know how much of a priority is being placed on these two wars inside of political circles.
Indeed. I mean, conventional wisdom always holds that foreign policy does not decide presidential elections, and I suspect it probably won't again. But you know, that said, the decline in Joe Biden's opinion poll numbers did seem to coincide with the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan. And then until this latest flurry of stories about the debate performance and the assassination attempt, you know, the war in Gaza was casting a huge shadow over the Biden campaign, very divisive in the Democratic Party. And You heard young progressives and Muslims and others saying, "I voted for Biden last time, but not this time." You know, he's backing a genocide in Gaza, and certainly next month in Chicago at the convention, we could see major protests over that, and it could be divisive. As for the Republicans, tonight at the convention, we heard from the parents of someone who is still in captivity. Mm. In Gaza, and you know, some Israeli flags being flown, some signs saying Jews for Republicans and so on. But otherwise, it's not been a major component of the convention. And similarly, Ukraine comes up occasionally, but it's well down the list compared to inflation and domestic issues. However, again, you know, the selection of J.D. Vance was certainly interpreted as very bad news for Ukraine. He's been extremely skeptical of that. He's written editorial columns about it. He's, you know, to sum up, he's made the point, you know, I don't understand why we're spending so much time and money on a war thousands of miles away when we have, you know, trouble on our own southern border. And I think that will be the pitch. So, a Republican victory for Trump and Vance would ring alarm bells in Ukraine for sure. Whereas Biden will argue democracy is on the line here, both domestically in America and abroad in Europe. And, a vote for him will maintain that battle.
I see you met with Kai, who's Donald Trump's granddaughter. She actually delivered a speech just a couple of minutes ago at the Republican National Convention. Seems to have impressed people. She's a young lady, so obviously, too close to call on whether or not she's actually got political ambitions of her own. But apparently, grandfather smiling from the seats while his granddaughter spoke there. It does feel a bit like a dynastic election for the Trumps here. I mean, they're all involved, right?
They all put...
you could argue, because Joe Biden said the other day that, you know, Hunter is the cleverest person he's ever known. And of course, Jill's very involved in what he's doing on a day-to-day basis, including, God knows, just getting up and going to sleep. So for both parts of this election, the Democrat candidate and the Republican candidate's parts here, family are playing a huge role. And, you know, maybe maybe David, maybe they should have kept with George III all those years ago, because the dynasties just seem to come into play no matter what, right?
Yes, because
America loves that.
Yes, exactly.
America loves to see a strong family. They love the idea of family values. I mean, bizarre as it was, the letter from Melania on a letterhead about, you know, America and Americans being resilient post the. I mean, America loves that shot.
Let's remember, this is also the nation of the Kennedys and the Clintons. So we've been here before with these big families. Certainly, this all-important decision Joe Biden has to make about whether he's going to stay in the race. And by the way, you know, let's remember, part of that is he has wanted to be president his entire life. It's hard to give up the crown when he's got there. But certainly, I think the view is the inner circle, the people who will really decide it, are his close family. Jill Biden, the First Lady, Hunter Biden, his son, and Valerie Biden Owens, his sister, who I interviewed a couple of years ago. A lot of it could hinge on them. And then, yes, on the Trump side, Donald Trump Jr. yesterday was saying he wants the power of veto over Biden's cabinet. You have Lara Trump, who is now vice chair of the Republican National Committee. Certainly critics say, what on earth qualification does she have apart from her last name is Trump? As you say, Trump's granddaughter came out today at the convention. I think following what we're saying earlier, this is, again, part of the softening of the image of Trump, projecting him as a cuddly grandfather, not the would-be fascist dictator that you've been hearing about from the Democratic Party. Just as an aside, I mean, it's of course, you know, at this convention, you know, let's remember, this is the man not only with, you know, criminal convictions, 34 counts, but he's been accused of sexual harassment by multiple women. There was the E. Jean Carroll case, the Stormy Daniels business. But to listen to these people, you'd think he was, you know, the purer than pure, a beautiful family man, and a champion of women and women's rights. But anyway, yes, the families on both sides are crucial, and let's not forget also Hunter Biden has a criminal conviction of his own from the other month. And you mentioned George III. I mean, and again, this kind of relates to the family. The Supreme Court in America recently upheld the idea of presidential immunity. The idea that when you're in office, you can commit any official act and be immune from investigation or prosecution. So that has underlined fears that Trump would have pretty much authoritarian powers if he returned.
I would be remiss not to refer to one of the things in the comments here, because we haven't been paying attention, but there have been some very good questions and comments made here. What do you think of the sudden endorsement of Trump by people like Elon Musk, people like Bill Ackman, who's been a lifelong Democrat and someone who's been a big donor to Democrat causes. There are more and more of these coming out of the woodwork now. Do you think that it was the assassination that tipped them, or do you think they've just given up on a Democratic Party that's tying all of its hopes to Joe Biden, who, some people will still believe can serve out another 4 years? That's doubtful to most of us.
A bit of both of those. I mean, the timing of those endorsements, it was just after the attempted assassination. And I think, you know, the way Trump responded, he probably will win over some friends. But I mean, with the super rich, they've often gone Republican because they think that means tax cuts, and it's going to be good for their bottom line, good for their business. Someone like Elon Musk in particular, he hates perceived wokeness, political correctness, all the things that Democrats are accused of, you know, DEI and so on. And so I mean, not entirely surprising that he would back Trump in this case.
Okay. Pums, you were going to say something and I interrupted you rudely.
No. I was just going to say, it's what is also quite astounding for me is that how many millions of Americans there are, and this is the best that you've got to put forward to be the leader of the free world, is really is also, an indictment on how people feel about politics and about putting their hands up and about being part of the solution, being there, as it were, and we here in South Africa talk about this all the time, about the people who play a role, the people who are being recycled as leaders. But it seems to be a problem that sticks all over the world.
I mean that presidential debate, an 81-year-old versus a 78-year-old, a man who can't finish a sentence versus a man who can't tell the truth, and you certainly did have Americans slapping their foreheads, thinking, is this really the best we can do? I mean, this is surreal and farcical. You certainly hear talk of a gerontocracy. There's some very elderly leaders in Congress as well, until recently. I think back to my sort of Africa reporting days at those moments, remembering the likes of Hastings Banda and Robert Mugabe and others who were, even older, and maybe not all shining examples either. Perhaps the good news is that finally, at long last, this might be the end. In 2028, I think it's assumed there will surely be a generational shift, whether it's someone like JD Vance, who's currently 39 on the Republican side, or on the Democratic side, a whole bunch of new youngish governors coming through, people like Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, Gavin Newsom of California, Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, Wes Moore of Maryland, also someone like Pete Buttigieg, the Transportation Secretary. And of course, if Joe Biden does drop out, they may get their chance even sooner. But I think there is a sense and a hope that that this might be the last gasp of that generation, because they've certainly been holding on for a very long time.
Well, there's still 3 months to go before the
Yeah.
election. What do you see, in your crystal ball? Next month is the DNC, but then there's still a long, long time in a very fast-paced news cycle. What do you see the next 3 months playing out as, and how big of an impact is what's happening in these past 3 weeks going to have on voting day?
I mean, obviously, anything I say will be foolish and wrong, because if you'd have asked me a month ago, I would not have predicted Biden's calamitous debate performance, and I would certainly not have predicted the assassination attempt. So there's so many, unknown unknowns out there in the countdown, of course, to the fabled October surprise that elections supposedly throw up. And looking back to 2016, that was first the Access Hollywood tape, where Trump was bragging about grabbing women by the private parts. And we also had the FBI investigation into Hillary Clinton. So I think more twists and turns are guaranteed. And in the short term, as you say, of course, the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, where I think they really have to try and assemble some kind of unity to match the Republicans. Otherwise, it could be on live television, total chaos and discord, protests over Gaza, people trying to oust Biden. It could be a nightmare. I would predict more shocks to the system, more twists and turns, more surprises. And yes, as we were saying earlier, probably none of it will radically shift the opinion polls one way or the other. So many minds are made up. But it could make those incremental differences that will actually be crucial in the end. I mean, remember that the 2016 election, although Hillary Clinton won by 3 million in the popular vote, in the electoral college that actually matters, she only won by 78,000. Sorry, Trump only won by 78,000 votes in three states. And then in 2020, Joe Biden won by an even more narrow margin in the electoral college in three states. So although everybody is currently saying Trump is bound to win this and it's all over, I actually think it remains a bit unpredictable and is likely to be very, very close.
Careful, if you talk about 2016 like that, people will call you an election denier. I mean, I do think Hillary's still wandering around somewhere in New York State in the woods telling people that she won that election. But, you know, nobody's listening to her. That's the difference. I think it's been fascinating to talk to you. And David, you always are a great resource. I appreciate you making time for us because you haven't been in this country for some time. And I'm sure that you're a man much in demand over there. You've got lots and lots of work to do. And thank you for sharing your firsthand experiences with us, as well as some really useful and interesting analysis of what's going on. Certainly is a hell of a year. And we've got much more to look forward to. I don't think anyone could have foreseen the week that we've had, the week that was before that, and all these weeks still to come. Let's brace ourselves. I think there's going to be a lot
what
more.
What a time to be alive.
All right.
Thank you for coming on, David.
Yeah, great to see you.
Thank you. David Smith, the Guardian's Washington, D.C. bureau chief. And of course, from 2010 to 2015, he was here in South Africa as the correspondent for The Guardian, which he was based in Johannesburg for. And a big thank you to the producers this morning, to Jack, to Sia, and also to Pumi Mashiro, who, of course, brings all the fire to the burning platform. We will see you in a week's time. And we're trying to bring you all kinds of insights, not into just South African politics, which we focused on quite a lot leading up to the elections, but also those big international stories and the ones that affect us the most. So if you have anything that you particularly want us to talk about, then please let us know. Drop us an email. You know how to get hold of us at the podcast party. And if you haven't subscribed to this channel yet, then please do so this morning so that you can keep updated with all the latest information. Thank you, everybody. We will see you next week.